You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon. With the Foreign Policy Program, we have the great honor today of welcoming Admiral John Richardson, the Chief of Naval Operations of the United States, the nation's top naval officer, to Brookings to talk about the state of the Navy and its future. Admiral Richardson is a 1982 graduate of Annapolis. He studied physics there, so not for the faint-hearted by any means. He also wound up getting a master's degree in electrical engineering from MIT, among other distinguished accomplishments, and an additional master's degree from the Navy in strategy. Has spent a lot of his career in submarines, where he commanded SSNs, attack submarines, but also had a stint with the Ballistic Missile Submarine Force. Spent also a large fraction of his career on European matters and thinking about theaters that become important again today as we contemplate the state of U.S.-Russia relations, among other challenges. So it's really a wonderful opportunity to have the Admiral here at Brookings. I'm going to ask you in just a moment to join me in welcoming him. But first, let me explain a little bit about our format for this morning. I'm going to sit down and give the Admiral the floor, and he'll speak for some 20, 25 minutes with his prepared remarks. Then I'll come up and join him for a brief conversation that we'll have before we go to you for questions, and we'll finish up about 9 o'clock. So again, we'd like to say how grateful we are, Admiral, to have you here. And please, everyone, join me in a big Brookings welcome for the Chief of Naval Operations.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for that warm introduction. And thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I would say that, you know, as I kind of get around, there are number of different types of speaking events that I participate in. There's those that I get invited to and I'd honestly rather not do, but it's probably something I need to do, and so you go and you do those. There are those that you get invited to and you don't have to do them and you don't want to do them and you just, you don't do them. But then there's some like today where we actually had a role in defining this, and so again, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity. This is a talk that I want to have. And there's been a number of those recently where we just have, I just want to get a message out. And that's what I'll do here from the podium, and I look forward to exploring that message in further detail through the Q&A. And I want to maybe anticipate one of the common questions that will come up during the question and answer period, which is, what keeps you up at night? I get, it's sort of a classic question, isn't it? What keeps you up at night? And I want to tell you that, sort of about this recurring dream that I have. And so it's just sort of bring you deep into my psychology. And it's a dream that begins on a sports field. And it's before the game starts. Right? And, for those of you who have competed in games, whether it's a sport or whether it's, chess or debating or something, you know what it's like to be in that sort of pre-game jitter phase, right? So there's this nervousness, there's this apprehension. Hey, what's going to go? You've put your plan together and you've prepared yourself as best you can, but then it's time to go and you engage. And so as the dream progresses, I get out on the field and we're all suited up, and we start, and there's first contact and all of that, and it turns out pretty well. And as the game progresses, it turns out our plan is doing well. We're actually getting ahead of the opponent. And it turns out that, as things go, by halftime, we're up. We're up significantly, like 28 to nothing, right? We're shutting the enemy out. We go into the locker room. And boy, now we're in the locker room, and there's lots of high fives. We're kind of holding the champagne bottle, wondering if we should crack it, right? Now, second half, kind of a just sort of a formality. We'll go through that, and we're talking about what are we going to do after the season? Are we going to go to Disney World? All of those sorts of talk, that type of chatter. There's none of the, let's study film. Let's explore deeply how we're going to adapt or any of that for the second half. And so we're going on. We're having this this halftime, kind of pre-celebration, pre-party, if you will. And it goes on, and some of the more experienced folks on the team sort of think, this seems like it's been going on a long time. I mean, it's it's a long halftime celebration. It seems like it's dragging on. And then, somebody comes bursting in, like the team manager or something. He says, "Hey, what are you guys doing? The second half is underway. The other team is taking the field. So we got to get our gear on. We go running out there. And, it's true. The second half is well underway. And, in fact, we went into the locker room with a 28-0 lead. But now it's like 24-28. Not only has the second half progressed, but the other team has made significant progress while we were in the locker room. And it's a much closer game right now. And they're all warmed up and ready to go. And the dream, the thing that snaps me awake is just staring into, we lock eyes with one of my competitors, the person right across the line. And you could just see from the look in his eyes that they spent their halftime in a much different posture. They were studying us intently. They went through all of the film of the first half. They have changed their approach completely. They have adapted their game to our strengths and weaknesses, to mitigate our strengths, exploit our vulnerabilities, and they are ready for this second half and have already moved out. And so, and then I kind of wake up in this. So that's what keeps me up at night, is that that recurring dream. And that's kind of at the root of my message this morning, which is that if there's something I would love to leave behind with you and everybody listening, is that we've got to capture a sense of urgency in what we are doing, a sense of urgency to retain our place in the world. And if we get that capture, that if we capture that sense of urgency, it will lead to a real change in our mindset, and our behaviors will become more competitive, and it will allow us to retain our lead. And we must retain it, right? We must, because while it's hard to retain it, it is so much harder to try and regain it once it's lost. So let's talk about this competition. Let's come out of the recurring dream and talk about the nature of competition that we face today. And I would, if I could characterize it in one word, and it's used a lot, and I worry that it gets a little stale, but the word is exponential. And the rules of the game, the way the game is adapted, it's become exponential. It's become exponential, fueled a lot by information technology, which is exponential in so many respects, right? First of all, there's just the advances in the capability of technology itself, whether you're talking about processing or storage or software. And then there's the exponential nature of the amount of information that's being produced, right? Something like doubling the amount of information in the world every 3 years or 2 years or something, a very exponential type of approach. And it's not just purely IT, but so many of the technologies that are IT-enabled. So you can talk about additive manufacturing. You can talk about unmanned and autonomous technologies, artificial intelligence, genetic science. All of these things take on an exponential character. And not only are these technologies being invented, but they're also being introduced so much faster and employed faster and faster. The distribution and adoption of these tools is about 10 times faster today than it was before. People get things faster and they use them faster. And so this idea of first use, first users, is a much more fleeting thing. It's very representative of sort of the early 1900s, right, the period between World War I and World War II, a very flat world in terms of information technology. And so this first user idea is fleeting, but it's decisive. And so we must, be faster than the competition. We must have outcomes that achieve advantage faster than our competition, and then stay faster, which requires us to say, okay, not only am I going to achieve this outcome, but what are my next two or three steps? Because the competition is going to be right behind me. And we have seen this. It's easy to describe this in maybe a theoretical context, but we've seen this in the maritime domain, in our maritime business. I was just kind of preparing for this talk a little bit. trying to get a sense for how long mankind has been going to sea. And, you know, I mean, what do you think? Who wants to venture a guess in terms of how long people have been going to sea? What's that? 2,000. 2,000. Come on, 2,000. Read your Bible. This is way longer than 2,000 years. you know, 10,000 easy. Conservatively 10,000. And they've been doing research in the Mediterranean on Crete that suggests that maybe 100,000 years ago, you know, people were doing deliberate voyages to get from one place to another. So let's think about, let's just say conservatively 10,000 years of people going to sea, okay? And you can start, you know, your curve 10,000 years ago and kind of plot the amount of maritime traffic from 10,000 years ago to today. The shape of that curve, think about it. The amount of traffic on the oceans has increased by a factor of 4 in the last 25 years, all right, which is an astounding fact if you think about getting our start 10,000 years ago. And so, again, there's this exponential nature to it. The technology that we talked about has allowed access to resources on the seafloor that were previously unreachable. Okay, and you can see minerals, natural gas, oil, you know, access to all of that is increasing the busyness of the maritime domain. The Arctic ice cap is smaller than it's been in my career, in my 35 years, since we've been measuring it. And that, again, has given access to continental shelves, to sea routes that weren't open before. And so, again, you know, this pace is picking up. And then, you know, we harken back to that information world that I talked about. About 99% of that information runs across the world on undersea cables. So, you know, the infrastructure that's there at sea, you know, another dimension of our world. Our food is largely, you know, more and more being done at sea, both protein and carbohydrate being grown and farmed at sea. And so it is a very exponential world, not only in technology, but also in the manifestation of that technology, particularly in the maritime domain. And so why, you know, so what, right? So what about this exponential thing? What's concerning about this is that the competition moves very fast, and in an exponential competition, there are only gold medals. It's winner take all. There's no silver medal, no bronze medal. It's winner take all. Think about competition in the business world where these technologies are involved. And it's hard to, while the number one business is easy to identify, it's very hard, much harder, to identify number two. It's almost like it doesn't matter. Okay? And so that's the nature of competition and why it should concern us. And our competition implies competitors, not just the rules of the game, not just the character of the game. And we do have competitors. And those competitors have been finding ways to leverage this environment in very clever ways. They've been studying us hard and analyzing our strengths and weaknesses. And so, you know, an important part of this thesis that I'm trying to make, this sense of urgency, is we are not alone in this. This is not just a theoretical experiment. We are here in a world with a number of partners and competitors. So let's, you know, take a quick scan through the competitors, because I know we'll get to this at Q&A. You know, China, in the news frequently in the last decade, has grown really from a regional maritime power to a global power in many sense. And their economic power is fueling a lot of that, building many more ships. Their fleet, by some projections, may exceed the U.S. fleet by 2030, have launched more ships than anybody else since 2013, more military ships. They're operating those ships further and further away, the One Belt, One Road plan, increasing their connection, and you can see that manifest itself by watching their naval deployments. They've got a port now in Djibouti. They're doing another port perhaps in Pakistan. Counter-piracy operations in the Gulf. They've got a space facility in Argentina, really kind of becoming a global power. Another competitor, Russia, and you really have to look no further than Syria to see kind of a vignette of Russian interplay in the environment right now. In support of Syria, they deployed their carrier, a small carrier strike group, to the Mediterranean and did strikes ashore. Their submarine activity remains brisk and increasingly brisk. As I said, there's been land attack not only from the Mediterranean, but also from their Caspian Sea fleet. And so, you know, who would have thought? And so they've been really testing out new systems, new techniques, new operations. They're the third largest military spender behind the United States and China, and their Navy's getting a fair share of this increase. They've fielded new submarine classes, three at least new submarine classes, six new classes of surface ships. And a lot of this arms is exported to other actors around the world. Another competitor, North Korea, was just enough said, right? And so just the concern about the level of escalation and unpredictability with North Korea. Iran, a small but growing fleet to include frigates and submarines. You know, provocative behavior in the Arabian Gulf and beyond, working very much through proxies. Again, you know, a beneficiary of technology sharing, and then, you know, using that technology through their proxies. So, you know, this malign influence that you hear about. And then, you know, if you just sort of stick with the 4+1 structure, this persistent violent extremism terrorist challenge. You know, the length of the campaign alone, 15 years, is something that's, you know, demands our attention. And the idea of, you know, the morphing of that that challenge over those 15 years, their ability to employ some of these new technologies very adroitly. And so it's, you know, it's clear, just to sum up, that our potential adversaries, our competitors, are not slowing down. They're employing this environment to. And our question now is, you know, what do we do to address this? How do we employ this sense of urgency? And so, our, you know, for the business leaders in the room, this will be nothing new, right? We study the competition, put together a plan to achieve outcomes, to compete. We adequately fund that program, put together a team of talented people to execute that. And then, in fact, we execute the program. And as I said, you know, the business leaders have been in competition by nature for some time, and so this is nothing new. But I would say that our focus on competition in my world has been different. We've been taking too long to get things done. And so I'll just step through each of those elements of the program and talk about what the Navy is doing to address each one. So in terms of putting together a program that is informed by our studying of the environment and the competition, we're getting after this in many fronts. We've reoriented, in fact, the way that we design our program, starting with the intelligence picture and then the strategy that is built as a result of studying that intelligence. So a very strategy-informed process, supported by analysis, supported by war games, all kind of coming into a tightened linkage between strategy, technology, and resources, kind of an end ways means. And then inviting a lot of people in to red team it. And so, and you've seen in the literature just a tremendous amount of discussion about future Navy, and I couldn't be happier with that dialogue that's going on. And so, a lot in terms of putting the program together, you know, tightening that system up and making it strategy informed. With respect to funding it, you know, we have less control here than with putting the program together. Here, of course, Congress plays a crucial role. As I've testified and as many people have said, you know, the lack of stable and predictable funding takes a tremendous toll on our ability to execute that program. And here we are on the eve of the end of the current continuing resolution, which is just the latest in a series of 8 years of continuing resolutions. We've operated for 30% of the last 8 years under a continuing resolution. And so if you want to go back to the sports analogy, You're really talking about trying to win the mile race by and spotting your competition a lap, right? Just, hey, you run three laps, I'll run four, and we'll try and beat you. Very hard to do. In fact, four of the longest continuing resolutions in the history of DOD have occurred in the last 6 years. And so that is moving in the wrong direction. The Budget Control Act, I would have to say it was based on assumptions of reduced threats, reduced complexity in the environment, and therefore a corresponding reduced op tempo that really have just not obtained. Okay, in fact, the environment's become more complex, more demanding, and op tempo has responded. And so this is, you know, just this is also not a short-term problem. A lot of times when people say, hey, how can I help you, what they imply by that question is, hey, how can I help you this year? And boy, I've got all sorts of answers for this year, but there is this looming thing about, well, about 10 years out, right, where we really start to see, you know, the major muscle movements of the budget need to be addressed. This is not something that's going to be solved with an all-nighter in 2026 or something like that. We need to start on the plan to rectify that, or our non-discretionary payments are going to cross the line of our total revenues, and depending upon who you look at, you know, 2030 is not a bad estimate of that. So we're committed to doing everything we can to, you know, with the resources that we get, that part that we do control, to be absolutely judicious with those, to make sure that we are as effective as possible with those resources, that we are being as innovative and creative, accountable for those resources, and so this will. But this resourcing issue is going to require vision and leadership by many. Next step is assembling the team. Again, here, you know, when we talk about competition, the competition for talent is another thing that is first and foremost in my mind. You know, the most valuable thing, the most priceless thing in the United States Navy is the sailor. And the Navy civilian, our people. And so very competitive space. We can't compete, you know, in many areas. We can't compete in salary, right? And so we've just got to take that for a fact. We're going to demand a lot of our people. We're going to demand you deploy for 6-7 months at a time, come back, and then deploy again. So it's an interesting challenge for us, and it's a remarkable testament that we are now celebrating our 10th consecutive year in terms of meeting our recruiting goals, 120 consecutive months of meeting those goals. And one, it speaks to the value proposition and the, I guess, the integrity and the service orientation of the current generation, which I see every single day as I move around the fleet. It is truly remarkable. And so, you know, attracted to our values proposition of honor, courage, and commitment, their desire to be part of that, to be part of something bigger, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And so we inside the Navy have to be mindful that we reflect those values in every action that we do, that our behavior as an organization is consistent with our values as a profession. And so our attributes of integrity, initiative, toughness, so that we're ready for this environment, and accountability are important efforts for us. We've issued two documents the Navy has to get after this, a framework that talks about how we want to develop leadership, and a framework that specifically addresses how we want to develop our civilian workforce. And so, you know, again, going after this increasingly competitive space for people, there's a 2014 report. You're familiar with these numbers. But of the 34 million people, kind of 17 to 24, over 70% not even eligible for military service. And of that, you know, only about 1% self-identify as being inclined to have a conversation with the military because of popular as an option for service. And so those are the same people that a lot of businesses are after as well. And it's not just even a national competition, is it an international competition? And so we have to be mindful that once we bring people in, that our personnel systems are as flexible, agile, up-to-date, cutting-edge as possible. And so we're doing a lot of work in that world to get after modifying, really transforming our personnel system. What I would, you know, what I'm striving for is a picture of every individual sailor. What are their priorities in terms of professional development, family development, you know, their entire life, so that we can then tailor a compensation package, if you will, our best offer to get after that. So if they want to fly around the world and be operators 100% of the time, I got a lot of jobs like that. If they want to stabilize in a particular area to put their kids through school or something, we've got opportunities there. And so we want to, you know, technology enables to get at that personal level of knowledge and then to package a program to address that. We'll probably never get 100% match, but we can do better. So there's a ton of potential here, again, leveraging this information technology. The way we teach and train, using virtual environments and measuring performance in those environments and then feeding back, you know, we can get people trained and effective much, much faster. So having put together the program, having achieved some funding, having put together the team then, now it's down to execution. And this involves execution on a number of levels. Our acquisition system is one that I get to spend a lot of time in. And here is a system that is fundamentally not built for competition. It is process-based, not outcome-based. In this process, there are a lot of people who get a vote, and I would say more accurately, not a vote, but a veto. And in the name of drawing down risk in some conception, but I'll tell you, it's a mindset that places very little value on outcomes, particularly outcomes in time, right? Competing in time. And you know that approach, I mean, our today's environment, as I started off with, demands that we compete in time. And so within the Navy, we're trying to drive agility into that. We've put together an accelerated acquisition program. We're adopting this, again, IT, this sort of digital physical pairing to get better insight into our systems from an acquisition and maintenance standpoint. And then also exploiting those in an operational perspective as well. None of this happens alone, and so we bring in a lot of partnerships when we move down these roads. Partnerships with industry. We're bringing industry leaders in earlier, so that we can have a dynamic conversation about where we need to put the marker down with respect to requirements. It allows us to find, you know, the knee in the curve everywhere we're talking about, so that we can find something that's achievable at a competitive time, at a reasonable risk, an identifiable risk, and at a cost that we can control. That's the knee of the curve. And then that'll be better than where we are right now. And as I said, in this exponential competition, even as we put that program together, we've got to be ready for the next step. And so think about a ship where parts of that ship may last for 30 years, the hull, okay, the propulsion plant. But the rest of it is built from the ground up to modernize every 5 years or so. And so this is, I think, a way that will allow us a platform for innovating our way into the future as new technologies come about. So industry becoming a much closer partner in that, as well our international partners. And so we have always fought with allies, and that won't change going forward. We're working very hard to focus our engagements in the international world on, again, going to explicit outcomes. To what end do these partnerships work? We've signed a trilateral agreement with the United Kingdom and Japan to increase our effectiveness in combined patrols. And it kind of tells you about the global nature of the maritime when you think about a partnership between, you know, Japan and the United Kingdom, 180 degrees of longitude apart with the United States. Last month, we signed another agreement with the United Kingdom and France to increase our focus and our cooperation in anti-submarine warfare and in carrier cooperation. And so look forward to building these partnerships more. Next month, I'll travel to Singapore for the IMDEX conference, and I look forward to strengthening and expanding those partnerships when I go. So a bright spot of execution is in the fleet. But I'll tell you, the fleet is operating tremendous skill and precision. You've seen some examples of that recently. Innovating their way that they operate, moving into the future, trying out new concepts. And so that part is a pretty healthy part of our business. And I give our fleet commanders tremendous credit in terms of moving forward in a very creative way. So I'll come to a close. I hope that I'm conveying that we need to recapture this sense of urgency, that within the Navy, we're doing everything within our power, putting our game face on to accelerate forward. But that won't be enough to really do what we need to do. We're going to need partners. It's going to be a multilateral effort. We'll have to focus with intensity on the problem at hand and recapture our momentum. So going back to this recurring dream, right? It's kind of like the Christmas Carol. Is this the ghost of Christmas? Is this our future as it will be, or a future as it can be? Can we change it? I would argue that if we get this sense of urgency, we have everything within our power to change this outcome, to maintain our place in the world. If we get this sense of urgency, if we look outside, with this sense of urgency, well, I'll say without it, it's going to be very hard to do anything definitive. With it, though, just to borrow a phrase from George Washington, everything glorious is possible. So thank you all very much for a chance to talk this morning, and I look forward to taking questions.
Admiral, thank you. That was fantastic. What a breadth of topics you raised, and what a breadth you have to think about. So I'm going to touch on a few, and then I know others will want to get involved as well. We had discussed earlier, you mentioned you've been speaking a lot about readiness, so I don't want to dwell on that. But if I could summarize what I think I heard you say, you're very happy still with the quality of people,
yeah,
and the fleet's performing well. So if I'm distilling out the main readiness concern I think you've had today and in other recent appearances, it's the pace at which you're operating would maybe be the number one challenge, or are there certain categories of equipment that are, in fact, breaking down or showing huge strain that you're particularly worried about?
Well, it is a kind of all of the above. So our model for readiness is that we're not going to send any forces forward that aren't fully certified for sort of whatever may come their way. So we send folks out certified for the high-end fight, if you will. But to really achieve success against more challenging possibilities, more challenging contingencies, you know, we have kind of, we have 100 ships right now forward deployed around the world, all right, about 75,000 sailors. Those folks are ready. They won't be sufficient against a high-end contingency, so you'll need to surge reinforcements. And those reinforcements need to be ready as well. And so it's becoming harder and harder to get that team out the door fully ready. And then those reinforcements are the decisive forces in a contingency are the ones where we have concerns. In particular, we've been very open about this, maintenance on ships and aircraft to kind of get those platforms ready so that we can steam them, we can fly them. That allows us to do that training. And, you know, this training thing is something that is, you know, time is, as I said, just an unforgiving variable there. So when you can't fly, it's not like you can go back and recapture that day, right? The experience goes down overall. And so we're very focused on those sorts of aspects.
So there's a lot of talk about how the Navy maybe should be aiming for 350 ships plus or minus. And I guess today you're right at about 300. Is that
about 275?
275 in terms of the number today, but 300 in terms of where the previous plan had
been. Yeah, the program of record right now gets about 308.
And so in this environment, And again, you alluded to the fact that none of us individually control the budget for the Navy. But we're in an environment where President Trump's proposed a $54 billion increase, but that's relative to a sequestration level. So it winds up, by my calculations, being only about half that much of an increase relative to a more normal sort of a Obama baseline. It's only 5%. That's not going to, by itself, allow you to grow to 350. And so I guess my question boils down to, in a fiscally constrained environment, what's more important to you, trying to push towards that 350 or trying to make sure we do the kind of innovation in everything from robotics to better cyber resilience to, you know, different kinds of space assets, unmanned systems, maybe a selective improvement in certain kinds of missile defense, directed energy research? If you had to, I realize you're going to say you can't choose, and I, right. but to the extent, are you worried that the push towards a larger fleet could crowd out innovation and modernization in some of those areas?
Michael, I can't choose. No. It is sort of all of the above, right? And so as we look forward to the future, as I said, there's been a great amount of discussion about what should the Navy look like in the future. I think there's a almost unanimous consensus that the future security environment is going to demand more Navy, right? A bigger Navy. I'll tell you what, if I built 355 of today's ships and operated them under today's concepts and projected that forward into the mid to late 2020s, that's probably not the force that would be decisive and would be able to protect America from attack, protect our interests around the world, promote our interests around the world. And so it really is a combination of both. We've got to innovate. It's absolutely essential that we do so. Otherwise, we will have an irrelevant Navy out there that will not be competitive in that future environment. So we've got to create space to innovate.
So it sounds like if we're going to go for 350 ships, either there would have to be a bigger increase than President Trump has proposed in the overall DOD top line, or there might have to be a shift within the DOD budget of which services, frankly, we're prioritizing in size in order to accommodate the competing need for a larger fleet and ongoing naval innovation. Is that fair to say?
I would put it this way. First, I would ask you just to stay tuned. So there has been a great discussion about future Navy. The one thing that's been missing from that is sort of what do we think? So there hasn't been a strong U.S. Navy voice on that. That is coming in the next few weeks. We're putting our final thoughts together about that. And what it will address is exactly your question. And so let's talk about the equivalent capability of 355 ships with some of these new innovative technologies that are really right around the corner. I mean, knocking on the door. You know, I'm not talking about, you know, something that's an idea or unobtained right now. And so there will be, you know, capacity dimension to that. The size of the Navy matters. If you look over the panorama I painted during my remarks, we're all over the world, right? Every place that there's conflict in U.S. interest, the U.S. Navy is there. So, and you got to have capacity to be there. So there will be a capacity part of this. But there is also this capability dimension. What do you do to provide credible options to leadership? Well, you got to be there to be credible and have an option, but you got to have the right capability set as well. And then, of course, you know, there's this discussion, is it a budget-informed strategy, strategy-informed budget, what have you? It's got to be mindful of the resources that are available. So that's our challenge, and we should be coming out with something compelling here in the next couple weeks.
Excellent. Thank you for the preview today. Yeah. Let me ask just briefly about China and Russia, and then we'll go to all of you. So with Admiral Harris, of course, has been in town, and I guess he's the longest-serving combatant commander now. He's had a lot of experience. We've heard a lot from him. I wondered if there's anything that you want to say yourself this week as we're digesting, you know, where we stand with North Korea, with China. I guess the way I would put the question is how do you feel about the state, especially of U.S.-China relations right now? Your Navy has done freedom of navigation operations, tried to begin the process of having 60% of the fleet in the western half of the world, so to speak, with the rebalance. How do you feel the state of the rebalance and the state of U.S. Navy engagement with China is right now?
Yeah. I would say that just if you look at the, just the last couple of weeks, and there's been a tremendous amount of focus on the USS Carl Vinson Strike Group. But think about what that strike group has done in those 2 weeks. One, it is down well, it started with a port call in Singapore. And so doing those sort of diplomatic engagement with Singapore, very important part of the world there. Oh, boy, if you think about the amount of traffic that flows through the Singapore Straits and all of that, is a very important partner. Then underway to do some pretty high-end exercises with Australia, one of our partner allies there, very capable ally. And so we like to do high-end things there. Started to transit north all along the way, you know, exerting an influence over its environment in terms of, hey, you know, we're going to navigate through international waters. Wherever international law allows, that's where we will be. And so there's that statement. We come further north. We start to work with our allies in the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. And so, again, this partnering opportunity. And now moving further north, you know, exerting an influence on the U.S.-Korea dynamic. And so a tremendous tool at the disposal of international leaders, the, you know, U.S. Leaders in particular. And so so that, you know, I think we just need to step back a little bit from sort of the day-to-day headlines and figure out, you know, appreciate what that has done. That's the sort of influence of this maritime maneuver force. And I think that it's very important with respect to your question. First of all, it's all going to be made very clear when I get through a glass half full. So I look forward to reading this, and thanks very much for
my new book with Jim Steinberg.
Yeah. So, but I do look forward to reading it. Just released yesterday. So, and the length is perfect. It's
try to come out in December for stocking stuffers.
That's right. But as I've talked to my counterparts in the People's Liberation Army Navy, like any fully dimensional relationship, it's complex. There are areas where we agree, where we have common interests. And, boy, we want to double down and really emphasize those areas. There are areas where we have disagreements, and we have to work together to resolve those disagreements. And then while we are doing that, while we are having those discussions, let's have an approach that minimizes the possibility of some kind of a tactical miscalculation to allow decision space, allow room for maneuver to resolve our disagreements. And so in the Asia Pacific, we have such an agreement put in place by my predecessors, the Code for Unplanned Encounters at Sea. By and large, many more navies are abiding by that, and it keeps things, you know, on track and sane and predictable, minimizes that chance for miscalculation. And so I think that that's sort of, you know, the general way forward.
That's going a little better than perhaps some of the encounters with Russia. Is that fair to say?
I would say that that is fair. We have such an agreement with Russia, the INC-SEA agreement. It was put in place in the Cold War. And it was put in place, really the thing that closed the deal in the Cold War was the consequences of such miscalculations, these sort of, you know, acts of bravado, if you will. Well, they were resulting in collisions. They were resulting in loss of life, et cetera. So we just had to stop that. And then there was this idea that something tactical could escalate. And so the agreement's there, but we're not seeing as much compliance with that agreement with Russia.
Well, okay, thank you. I've had a great opportunity to ask some questions, so now I'll share the pleasure with those of you in the audience. So please wait for a microphone, identify yourself, and if you could keep it to just one question so we can get through a few of them. Start here in the fourth row, please.
Good morning, Admiral Otto Kreischer with Sea Power Magazine. You've talked about the budget situation. You're now in a thing where Congress is likely to do another minor CR before giving you a budget. And there's the question of how much of a supplemental, how much can you spend if Congress actually gives you something close to what the NDAA recommended,
yeah,
and then some supplemental. How much can you actually spend in this year?
All of it.
And what would you do with it?
I'll spend it all. Now, we have an obligation, right? This goes to this judicious, responsible dimension of this discussion that's completely on me, right? And so it has been an absolute requirement that as we have watched this discussion, participated in this discussion, every single dime will be executable inside, you know, the appropriate time frame. So you know that it kind of depends on the color of money, if you will. But we'll be able to execute. That's part of the deal.
I think there was one more question up here. We'll stay up and then in that same row.
Thank you. Hi, Admiral Mark Sellinger with Defense Daily. You mentioned you're going to come out with something in the next few weeks. Are you referring to the 30-year shipbuilding plan or some other
document? This will be an article that will describe our vision of the future Navy. So it's not the 30-year shipbuilding plan.
And if you could just pass the microphone to the gentleman to your right and in front, that'd be great. Thank you.
They took my questions.
Okay.
There you go.
The woman here just to...
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Nike Ching. I'm the State Department correspondent for Voice of America. I hope you like to answer my question, not have to answer my question. So here you go. What is the discussion on frequency of phone-up in the South China Sea under this administration? And more, is that more frequent than quarterly? And as the administration is reaching its 100-day, was there already a phone-up in the South China Sea? Separately, if both of you could please address the danger of creating the perception that North Korea's threats are overshadowing territorial disputes in the South China Sea, that would be great. Thank you.
I'll go first.
Please.
Well, first, in terms of discussion of future operations, it's just something I'm not going to touch on. And so the frequency of future operations, including freedom of navigation types of operations, I don't think it's useful to describe those. Except that, you know, freedom of navigation as an expression of our advocacy for international rules and norms, going where international law allows us to transit, doing so in a way that shows resolve in that area, you know, a strength of our position. It would be great if we could, because it is international law, I think greater international participation there would be something to look forward to as sort of a strategic approach to that. With respect to the dynamic of, I think if I understand your question, you know, the current press on North Korea versus sort of the persistent challenge, not only in the South China Sea, but around the world, always a challenge, isn't it, to make sure that you're not sort of captivated by the bright and shiny object of the current headlines and take your eye off the broader strategic currents that are flowing around the world. And so we'll do our best to maintain our balance there.
I'll give a quick additional thought, which is, while I certainly agree with the Admiral, I would also say I am more worried about the behavior of North Korea than the behavior of China. I think we have a viable strategy that the Navy and other services are implementing. It's not a done deal. We have to keep very vigilant on the issue of the South China Sea. But I feel that the U.S. and Chinese militaries and governments are both essentially, on both sides of the Pacific, professional in some sense. They're not every aspect of the Chinese government do I equally admire, but I don't feel like they want a war. I feel like they're trying to flex their muscles as they're becoming a near superpower, and they're doing it in ways that cause us angst, but I think we have a relatively viable strategy for how to push back, whereas Kim Jong-un scares me. I don't know how to understand how he views the world. I don't know what his goals are. Unfortunately, he kills off a lot of the inner circle that might give him advice on issues that he needs to hear when he's got something wrong, and even though I don't think he wants war either, he is more unpredictable. He's in more of a one-man echo chamber, and he's doing some very dangerous things. So I actually think we have to focus on North Korea quite a bit. I'm not sure that the posturing that's been going on lately really solves the problem, and I don't think anybody would claim it does, but I think that the North Korean threat is at least as worrisome to me as the Chinese threat. The time horizons may be slightly different, but the North Korean threat's been there a while too, and it's not going away anytime soon.
Maybe if I could add on to that, when we go back to U.S.-China relations, what a fruitful area for us both to cooperate on in terms of addressing the North Korean threat. And so I think there's a real opportunity there for us to come together and collaborate on that, an approach to that threat.
Okay, so gentlemen in the eighth row, keep working our way back.
Thank you, Admiral. My name is Weldon. I'm a graduate student at Johns Hopkins SAIS. Admiral Zunkov, the commandant of the Coast Guard, was here at Brookings back in November. And among other things, he discussed the role of Coast Guard in the Asia Pacific. And he's also been quoted in the press as being in discussions with you, sir, about the Coast Guard's role in the region. Can you tell us anything about the state of those deliberations and or how you envision the Coast Guard's role in American defense strategy and naval strategy in general?
Yeah, as I think about it, it's a great question. And Paul Zukov and I, you know, talk a lot about this. So we have habitual staff talks to make sure that, you know, as we approach this, as I see it, it's really a matter of maritime security, right? And so it includes not just Navy, but also the Coast Guard and also our Merchant Marine Force and, you know, so many other dimensions that come into making sure that as a maritime nation, the United States has a firm grasp on maritime security, you know, through which we get so much. So much of our trade is manifested over the seas, and so the Coast Guard has capabilities and particularly authorities that we don't have with respect to law enforcement, and so we want to make sure that we move forward in a very collaborative and also deliberate manner so that we are using, you know, each of our capabilities and authorities to best effect and not duplicating or, you know, being random about things. So I would say that in particular, where, you know, we have trouble meeting demands just because of priorities in places like the Arctic and places like the Caribbean, boy, that's where the Coast Guard has been just fantastic in terms of covering down on establishing U.S. maritime security in those areas.
A couple of hands about 10 rows back. Start here on my right, please.
Hi, Admiral. Caroline Houck with Defense One. I wanted to ask about the March memo that you issued asking members of the Navy to think more strategically about their communication, their public communication. There's been some reports that it has encouraged some people to just tamp down on all communication. What has been your perspective on how people have responded?
I'll tell you, it's interesting. Whenever you put a communication like that out, or any communication, it's, you know, the way that different people interpret that is always so a communication like that is just the beginning of a dialogue, and I appreciate you letting me continue that. I think that, and I made it clear in the memo, this does not mean stop communicating, right? And so this just means, hey, there are some things that I believe strongly, particularly in a, if you buy my theory that we are in a competitive environment, right? So use a sports analogy type of a thing, again, because it allows us all to identify with it. If I'm going into a game, I'm not going to give the other coach my playbook, right? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And so there are, I would say, appropriate venues. And so as the questions have come up, it's sort of, you know, the industry, the business community has come back to me and said, hey, I thought you were supposed to, you know, you were saying we want to communicate more with industry. And I say, yeah, I do, right? In the appropriate setting, in the appropriate venue, we'll have all the conversations that we need to have to do real good business together. In the media, boy, there's an awful lot that we could be talking about that is interesting and vital. But when we get down to specific capabilities, you know, weapon system capabilities, when we get down to specific operations, it's just, you know, in an era of competition, we have to be thoughtful about that so that we don't, you know, show our hand. So that was really what I was after.
I'm going to ask one more question on the sports metaphor before we go to the last couple here. By the way, for a minute, it sounded like you were a recovering Atlanta Falcons fan because I think they were actually ahead 28-3 in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
God bless them. I still don't know what happened in that game. But it was about adaptation.
Yeah,
that's
right?
A good point.
I mean, in the first half, you could see the Patriots moving and adapting on the fly.
Yeah. That's a good point, actually. Yeah. And so, and it's about weapons and vulnerabilities and threats. And so, in that regard, if you had to. I know you've got a lot of concerns about where we could fall behind, but if you had to pick one or two, it seems to me that you know, cyber and space vulnerability and missiles and maybe submarine threats would be among my top four. But would you prioritize among that list or add any?
Well, I'll tell you, all of those would go in, you know, group one.
Yeah.
You know, and so I mean, as we think about where we need to innovate. In particular, we enjoy an advantage right now undersea, but boy, that's fleeting, right? If we don't continue to mine that closely, that advantage will evaporate. And so we've got to be mindful of the competitive space in the undersea and continue to invest there. With respect to missiles, we've got to innovate, right? I mean, we are on the wrong side of the cost curve on this. Interceptors are very expensive and few, and they have to go up against potentially much less expensive and many missiles. And so how do we turn that around? And so there, I think that there's some solutions right around the corner that allow us to do that. With respect to space and cyber, I mean, if you go back to the last time where we might want to consider ourselves into real competitive 25 years ago, nobody was talking about those at all. And so trying to appreciate, get our mind around those as competitive, even warfighting domains, just a tremendous challenge. So I would say all four of those are front and center.
So I think there were two hands in that very back area. Maybe we take those together as we wrap up, and we'll see if we still have time to come forward after that. Take the two questions together, please.
Good morning, sir. Brett Crade from the Association of the United States Navy. On the issue of rapid acquisition, Admiral Moran spoke very passionately and encouragingly about it during Sea Air Space. I was wondering, his comments were specifically within the context of tactical aircraft programs. I was wondering if the rest of the PEOs are as amped up and passionate about championing that, and also if you could point to a specific example of where rapid acquisition has really played out in the Navy recently.
Okay. Well, with respect to acquisition, this is an area also, as I talk about processes, that we have got to challenge all of our assumptions, right? So it just takes too long to do stuff. And it, for the private sector, for industry, to the degree that I can characterize, and I'll probably oversimplify it, which is, is dangerous. But there's sort of two regimes that they operate in if they do business both commercially and with government. There's sort of a fast-moving competitive regime, very dynamic, that they have to do to compete in the private sector, in the commercial environment. And then there's their government business, which is like in a different world. It's almost like a science fiction movie, where people are moving around at different timescales. And so much slower, much less responsive, much more process dominant, and much less competitive, to be honest. And so we've got to come over more towards these much more dynamic acquisition models. Why does it take us so long to design a ship these days? Why does it take us so long to build that ship once designed, or aircraft, or whatever, right? And then when we design that ship, if we take the last ship and iterate it forward, we're going to miss a tremendous opportunity in terms of providing a platform for innovation to the future. And so we're working very hard with industry right now to really do a full court press on those assumptions and get things done faster. I mean, design the ship in one half of the time that historically we've done. Build that thing faster. Now, that requires stable and predictable funding, right? It's a business proposition on their side. And so their corporate investors and their stockholders are looking for a signal of confidence that this is an area where they can invest and get a return. And so it all kind of has to work together.
We'll have the one last question there and finish up here.
Hey, sir. Justin Doubleday with Inside the Navy. The Congressional Budget Office just came out with a report this week that said it would cost about $26 billion a year to build up to 355 ships. That's using, of course, today's fleet architecture, today's ships. Will your future fleet projection that you're coming out with, will that include a discussion of cost at all? And what's your assessment of CBO's numbers?
I haven't had a chance to study the cost, the details of CBO's numbers. But to answer your question, it kind of goes back to the discussion earlier. If we just have a resource uninformed wish list for the future, it's worth the paper it's written on, right? Or maybe not even. And so it's got to be resource informed if it's going to be legitimate going forward.
And then right up here for our final question, please.
Adi Zolotov, Center for Naval Analysis. Sir, you discussed the rate of data creation increasing very rapidly. And I think that leveraging the power of that data requires a level of skill to do in very computationally intensive analytics. And big data and machine learning, artificial intelligence, some of the things you discussed. What's your plan? What's your vision for bringing those things to the Navy so that you can harness that analytic power?
Yeah, I think that that is really the new competitive space, right, in terms of achieving advantage. There is no shortage of data, sensor data anymore, right? And there's really no shortage of payload options, kinetic and non-kinetic. But it's stitching all that together, right? What is the network that brings all of that together? And then, you know, if I think about sensors at one level and I think about payloads at another, in between are sort of the orient and decide part. That's making sense of all of that so that you can come to decisions and then employ a payload, the not only a payload, but the payload, the most optimum payload to achieve the effect you need. That's gonna require help. And a lot of that help is going to be an artificial intelligence that can tee up the decisions for people to make, because we are talking about weapons deployment here. And so tremendous space there in terms of getting after how to do that. What are the ethical dimensions of that? We've got to start exploring that now so that we get into the O and the D of the OODA loop, because I think that's where the competition is now.
Well, Admiral, thank you for joining us at Brookings. Thank you for what you're doing for the country in these very, very challenging times. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks for the great book.